Next case for argument is AMAX versus Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. Mr. Solomons.
Good morning. I had reserved just 1 minute for rebuttal, not three. This is an employer's black lung appeal. It raises quite a few issues. I'll try to touch on each and identify the main premises we argue.
Well, why don't you just touch on the most important, since you only have 10 minutes.
Okay. My plan. The black lung program is a torture chamber for employers.
Well, okay, get to the point.
Yeah, okay. What we claim is that it took 18 years from the time this person filed a claim until the time there was a meaningful hearing. There is no justification for that. It caused us significant deprivation. I'm going to tell you what those deprivations were. First of all, the claim had gone to hearing when it was supposed to in 1981. It would have been denied. It had to be denied because the minor was going back to work. And therefore, it was under this whole interim presumption, and there was an absolute defense of his having gone back to work under the regulatory section. Just like the Sixth Circuit's decision in Holdman. Second of all, we were denied. And this is the kind of case where, first of all, the minor was off work for a while because he had a fractured skull, and then he had a heart attack or some kind of significant cardiac event that caused him to leave work again. He was never really released for work again to do the kind of, and his employer told him he could not come back to work. He had bypass graft surgery in 1982, and we were deprived by the administrative law judges because of the confusion that existed at that time of developing contemporary evidence during the period from 1982 probably until about 1994. They wouldn't let us develop any evidence, and we can't make claimants go to doctors. The administrative law judge in his decision in 1985 said that we weren't entitled to have an examination. We weren't entitled to obtain more medical evidence because the only question was, after his 1981 hearing, where the claimant said he wanted to withdraw his claim, we agreed to that. There was no question about the fact that there was no entitlement. Everybody agreed to it. And the Department of Labor wanted its money back. So it took the Department of Labor 10 years to establish its right to get it, or maybe not 10 years, five years to establish its right to get its money back, during which time all of the contemporary evidence that we could have developed during that period we weren't allowed to develop. And then the interesting thing was, in the administrative law judge's final decision in 1997, there was remand. He wouldn't even consider the evidence that was developed in the treatment of this minor. He said it didn't matter. The x-rays didn't matter. Nothing mattered. We only went on the litigation evidence. And he refused to consider the x-rays that were developed during that period. We also, because of that, were deprived, at least to some degree, at least we were damaged in making the defense under this court's decision in Vigna that the man's disability really didn't have anything to do with pneumoconiosis. If he had it, it had to do with his non-occupational heart attack. Good defense. Our evidence, by the time we got to a hearing when we were allowed to develop evidence, when the board remanded the case in 1997, so that the administrative law judge would give us an opportunity to develop some evidence in 1998 to submit the depositions of our experts, who were two good experts, it just was too late. The time for contemporary evidence had long passed. And of course, you know, and another factor, when you get these huge delays in these cases, and I think that comes through very clearly here, it comes through in our argument on the merits, is you have three administrative law judges here. Only the last one was inclined to give to make an award of benefits in this case. So what happens? I mean, you have an administrative...
Well, I don't understand. What legal principle are you arguing?
Oh, we're arguing that the delay in this case deprived us of a variety of different litigation rights and therefore denied us due process of law. I think that it's a principle that has been recognized in the Fourth Circuit.
I don't think that's going anywhere.
Well, we were deprived of these rights. You get it. The employer loses the.
So what are we supposed to do? Order Congress to.
No, you don't have to do anything. Do what the Fourth Circuit.
Order Congress to appropriate more money so that this office can. All these cases are ages old.
Well, Your Honor, if you don't make
them special about this case.
Well, I think this is a special case because...
Why? What's special about it?
Because in this case, we have deprivation. In this case, the employer was first of all, put in a position of not being able...
It hardly helps the employee to have these delays either, so is there an equality of hardship?
That's true, too. But the problem is that the employee here gets his money. The employee gets some benefit from this, and we get nothing but...
The employee is dead. He does not get anything.
Well, he did get it for a while because the Labor Department was paying him his money, and we just have to pay the Labor Department back, I suppose.
How much is that?
They said it was $155,000, but they paid him for when he was working, and they paid him for when he was off with his fractured skull. So I don't know what the real number is. I mean, and there's interest if we have to repay them. But the fact of the matter is also that for the employer, that this is significant economic hardship to have these cases pending. We come to the courts, we come to the Fourth Circuit, we come to the Sixth Circuit, we're coming here. Because we need to have the protection of the courts from this kind of delay. It's not something that's acceptable. It's outrageous. It just doesn't happen anyplace else.
Unique to this? Do all these cases that are so delayed go back to the pre-presumption cancellation?
Well, some do and some don't. And I mean, we shouldn't have had to even go into the interim presumption. This case should have been under the new regulations that came out in 1980, because the guy wasn't eligible for that period. But because of the delays and because of the continued sort of regurgitation of this case through the system, we're operating under a presumption that Congress found to be scientifically invalid, and it makes an enormous difference.
In this appeal, are you disputing that you're under the old rules?
No. I mean, we're disputing that we should have to pay. And the way it works is that if we don't have to pay, the trust fund pays. The Black Lung Trust Fund ought to pay this claim, not the employer. The employer's rights were violated in order to create an award here. And that is a proposition that is within the statute. Nobody's got to go to Congress, Your Honor, to get this thing done. I mean, the Fourth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit have already established that, but it's clear in the statute also. We move on to two other things. I think that on the merits on the merits, what you have here is a situation where, because of the kind of advocacy that gets behind a claim that's this old, what you have are two detailed, extensively explained depositions by pulmonary disease specialists explaining how none of this guy's symptoms, none of his findings really show disability due to black lung disease. But they didn't consider that to be very credible. They preferred all these conclusory statements of other people with less credentials. Now, maybe that's supported by substantial evidence, but the fact of the matter is that goes more so to the deprivation issue, I think. But also, I mean, here we have a situation where what the record shows, and under this court's decisions in Vigna and Foster, the man's disability due to pneumoconiosis, which was established, you know, well after retirement age, was due in the first instance to a heart attack and bypass surgery, and then they would let him go back to work. Under Vigna, we shouldn't have to pay that case. On the back benefits, on the default proposition, the Department of Labor says, what we argue is that Section 6 of the Longshore Act says that, and it applies here, says that benefits are paid from the date the disability begins. Department of Labor defaults to some other date under the regulations, and we argue that is a presumption. In fact,
well, what date would you like to use?
Well, I don't see that before they didn't establish the evidence that establishes the disability here that the ALJ relied upon is from 1995 or 1996. Not
I don't know what you're saying. What is your candidate for the date of onset?
Well, I think that the first time that there's a, I didn't have a, I think we did identify it in a date. It was sometime in 1995 we identified a date in our brief.
What's your theory? How do you determine the date of onset?
Well, it's a question of fact. We decided by
so
the...
So what's your position? I don't understand.
Well, the administrative law judge has got to look at the evidence and decide when the pneumoconiosis reached the point where it had disabled the miner to do his work.
And when was that?
Well, like I said, I think it was sometime in 1995.
And what is your basis for that?
Because that's the medical evidence that the ALJ principally relied upon to find entitlement.
That's the date of the medical evidence?
Well, it's the approximate date of the medical
evidence. Well, how is the date of the medical evidence related to the date of onset?
Well, I mean, that's when there's proof that shows that the individual has reached entitlement.
No, no. I mean, the date at which a report is made is not the same thing as the date of the disease that the report is about. You're using the date of the diagnosis, not the date of the onset, aren't you?
Well, what we're using is an approximate time. I mean, it's a question of fact. ALJs face questions of fact all the time. That's their job, is to decide them. Well.
And, but okay, thank you, Mr. Zollins. Just Mr. Tsai or Mr. or Ms. Vogel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm going to address the merits, and I'll speak briefly on attorney's fees. This appeal begins from the point that Mr. Chubb successfully invoked the presumption that he is totally disabled due to pneumoconiosis under A2. That moves us to the burden of the company to rebut that presumption. The issues on rebuttal come under
B4. If he had filed this claim at the time he finally did retire, we would not be working under these regulations, would we?
I believe that was in 83. It would be under the new regulations.
And
Your Honor, that goes to the due process argument.
Well, if I may, the ALJ said that was the fix that as the day as the date when benefits ought to begin. Correct?
Is what date?
The date that he retired.
That's what the board told the ALJ to do.
Okay. So you really, he's qualifying for benefits under the old regs, but doesn't get them until a date within the ambit of the new regs.
Again, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to address that issue. Mr. Seid's going to address that issue.
I hope somebody does, because it's bothersome issue.
Okay, I'm addressing the merits of invocation and rebuttal. Under rebuttal, they have to establish that Mr. Chubbs was not totally disabled due to pneumoconiosis, and we only have two of the provisions that we're working with here, and one had to do with the x-rays. And the administrative law judge used quality, recency, and quantity as determining factors for finding that the x-ray evidence did not support rebuttal. And these are permissible factors for weighing x-rays under Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit law. AMAX also relied on the medical opinion evidence under B3. There were seven relevant opinions that the ALJ considered. Five of those opinions support finding that Mr. Chubbs was totally disabled due to pneumoconiosis, and there's no dispute on that, which only left the two opinions submitted by AMAX. And on appeal, AMAX is asking this court to substitute its judgment for the way that the ALJ made a finding that they too do not support rebuttal, because neither one of these physicians found total disability based on pulmonary impairment, and neither one found co-worker's pneumoconiosis. So the judge's rejection of both opinions on rebuttal are rational and supported by the evidence. And briefly on attorney's fees, I would just like to say that the issue here is that AMAX is demanding evidence of my market rate. I don't have a market rate. My law firm does not have a market rate, and the court doesn't require a market rate for analysis. The next best type of evidence was provided here, and
well, what do you mean when you say you don't have a market rate?
We don't have fee-paying clients.
Sorry?
We do not have fee-paying clients. We only do black lung, and that's how the market rate is generally established, is based on what you charge your fee-paying clients. So when we submitted the evidence, the next best type of evidence, which this court approved of very recently, just last month in Goodloe, the burden then shifted to AMAX to show why the hourly rate should be lower, and they did not do that.
Well, what was the evidence for your hourly rate?
The evidence was my resume, the affidavits from the other lawyers.
Who are these other lawyers? They're black lung lawyers too?
Most of them are black lung lawyers.
Well,
and there was
kind
one
of
who
cozy little system, isn't it? Each of you will, of course, have an interest in supporting the other's claim for a high fee.
Those lawyers represent the only community for black lung litigation.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound as if it has, what they say has any probative value.
And there's the one from the Jackson County Bar Association president. And the court has said that too, from the local bar.
What does he know? I mean, what does he know?
He's talking about the local market rate, if that's going to be applicable.
But what does he know about black lung cases?
He doesn't. The other attorneys know about the black lung. There are no other attorneys that know about black lung. None. Pretty much these people who did these affidavits, these other attorneys, that's it.
Well, what about other benefits cases like Social Security? Are there no broader norms about, maybe not.
Your Honor, in Goodloe last month, you said, if that's the rate that you claim is your usual and customary rate, and you give evidence of that rate, that's your rate.
Right.
And the board
had
every right to accept that as the hourly rate.
It doesn't sound like evidence in any serious sense, but that's okay. Maybe there's nothing else. Okay,
thank you,
Ms. Fogel. Mr. Sides?
Mr. Side, your co-counsel indicated that my question didn't come within her $200 an hour expertise. Maybe you could answer it for me.
Yes,
the government rate.
Yes, Your Honor. Substantially lower. Let me explain. Mr. Chubb filed his claim in 1978. The date that he files dictates which entitlement criteria apply to his claim. He returned to coal mining in 1981 and retired in 1982. That fact has no bearing on which entitlement criteria are used to determine whether he is totally disabled. That fact of his return to coal mine employment could be taken into account in determining when his benefits should commence, and if he were ultimately to have been awarded benefits, any period during which he worked, beginning with 1978, for lack of a better date, would be his benefits would be suspended for that period. He simply would not draw them. It would not affect his underlying entitlement.
You made that point in a footnote in your brief.
Yes,
what we could really do here is say that the it was filed back in the late 70s. There was a period of suspension of benefits.
Correct.
But my problem, I suppose, is that the ALJ decided that the date when the payments ought to begin was after that work period. Isn't that supposedly then the date that he was eligible for benefits, that the black lung became disabling as of that date?
I believe, Your Honor, that date emerged more or less in error. I think the Benefits Review Board suggested in a remand that would be the appropriate date, not taking into consideration that he could legally begin to receive benefits in 1978 and only have his entitlement suspended for that one-year period of when
that would be the way it ought to have been
that's
done.
The way it ought to have played out had everybody been following the regulations.
If it had been done that way, would this gentleman have actually gotten more benefits than he did? I would think he would be eligible for some benefits while before he resumed working.
Your Honor, I believe that he received benefits paid by the trust fund on an interim basis beginning in August 1978 with a period suspended, or he ceased to receive benefits during the periods when decisions denying his claim were in effect. If the September 1982 date were ultimately to be affirmed, then the 3 years that the trust fund paid, I think, would simply be money that we could not recover from the coal company.
So this just becomes an issue really between you and the coal company?
For that period of time, yes. If ultimately the award of benefits is affirmed commencing September 1982, which is what the date the ALJ selected, the coal company would legally be obliged only to pay from that date forward, because the litigation has established that date as the period for which it is responsible. the benefits that we paid prior to that time are not being found to be their responsibility, would simply be money that the trust fund would consume or attempt possibly to recover from the claimant as an overpayment. But that period of time is simply, it's a matter of...
But it is a matter of contest then between you and the coal miner, or the coal, or the widow at this point.
No, we're on the same side.
No, I mean, if you said you would try to recover it as an overpayment, then it does make a difference as to whether or not how we decide the matter.
It would only be an overpayment if it were found at the conclusion of the litigation that Mr. Chubb was not found to be entitled to benefits for that period.
Isn't in effect that the net result if we're going to determine benefits as of the day he retired in 83?
82. I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
No, isn't that correct? I mean, wouldn't that be the bottom line of if we were to affirm that the benefits were supposed to begin in 82, 83, we are leaving his widow with that exposure for the earlier benefits.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would like to point out that most overpayments are, a claimant has the right to ask that the overpayment be excused. She can establish that she's unable to repay the benefits.
Well, why not just deduct it from the benefit, from the new benefits?
We could also do that, I believe.
And then we'll have some more litigation, and why don't we just get this cooked now? Is there any reason why we couldn't just simply say that the benefits were supposed to begin at the earlier date and be done with it?
I don't think there is anything that would stop you from doing that. No party has asked that date be adopted, but if the court were to find that is legally speaking the correct onset date, less the period of time Mr. Chubb was employed, then that's the onset date. If the regulation had been applied as written and as intended,
That is the position of the agency charged with the administration of the statute, is it not?
Yes.
Before you sit down, a question about the onset date. So you use the onset date, the date that he quit work, is that correct?
In this particular case, that's what would that
now, used. Now, is that a rebuttable presumption or is that absolute?
It's a rebuttable presumption. The way it's intended to work, first the claimant, the minor, proves that he's totally disabled by black lung disease. Having proven that, the question becomes when do his benefits begin? The onset date regulation instructs the fact finder first to determine whether the evidence can pinpoint a particular date and time when the minor became totally disabled. If the evidence is inconclusive, then it instructs the administrative law judge to apply the default date of the application date. Even then, that date cannot or will not control if the party opposing entitlement introduces any credible evidence. Or if there's evidence.
So when he went back to work, that's why you don't use the application date.
You don't use that application date because the Black Lung Act itself says that a minor may not receive benefits for any period of time during which he's employed in coal mine employment. It doesn't matter if he's employed in a job in which he has reduced ability to perform it. It's simply the fact that he's drawing wages in the coal mining industry. As a matter of his physical condition, he could be entitled to benefits in the sense that he is actually totally disabled. It may be that his employer, out of an excess of niceness or whatever, is carrying him in a make-work position. If he's drawing wages, he can't receive benefits, even though he is, legally speaking, totally disabled and otherwise entitled. And a minor who is working at the time that his claim is adjudicated and found meritorious, he still has 1 year to retire. Once he has the final award in place, he has 1 year in which to retire thereafter before the claim would then be deemed denied because he's still working.
But okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Stein. Does Mr. Solomon have any more time?
No.
Time expired? Okay, well, thank you to both counsel.